Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
From Ballina to the Senate and Oras and Uachtaráin on to the United Nations, Mary Robinson's life and career has traversed many arenas. The journey of the world-renowned human rights leader has now been put on film for a new documentary about her life titled Mrs. Robinson and will be on general release towards the end of this month. Ahead of its release, I'm joined on the line now by the Chair of the Elders, the first woman President of Ireland and former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mrs. Robinson herself, to talk about the documentary and her career. Good morning to you, Mary Robinson.
Good morning.
What is it like, I wonder, to have to sit down in front of a television camera and go over not just your entire career, but your personal life too? Was it comfortable? Was it uncomfortable? Or was it, I suspect, something that you looked upon as a platform for your climate advocacy?
Well, actually, I didn't want to make the film. It was Bride Rosny, my dear friend, who said, no, you must. You've had a very full life. You can be an inspiration to people. You should do it. And I realise now that she was right about that, that we all need inspiration. But I hadn't contemplated that I would end up doing it. And I must say, I think Aoife Kelleher, the director, has made a wonderful job of a long, complicated life.
So it must be a bittersweet thing looking at this now, because, of course, we have lost Bride Rosny since this went into production. Somebody who was at your side for a very, very large part of your adult life.
Very much so, and very close, not just to me, but to my whole family. So we've lost a dear, dear person who was as close as any sister could ever be. I never had a sister, but Bride was certainly like a sister, and she told me the things a sister tells, not the things you want to hear, but the things you need to hear. Mm. She loved doing that.
Turning to brothers then, you say very early on in the documentary that you spent a pretty large amount of time looking out of a bedroom window over the River Moy in Ballina, thinking about the injustices that you wanted to write. What sort of injustices were you talking about? Was this being one girl in a family of five children?
It was more what was happening outside the family. I mean, there's no doubt those four brothers did encourage me to value gender equality and human rights and even using my elbows. But what was more interesting was the way my parents kept saying to me, you have exactly the same opportunities as your brothers. Never forget that, Mary. But it wasn't true. It wasn't true of Irish society. And I could see it wasn't true. I mean, my brothers were altar boys. I had no chance of being an altar girl. I had to wear a horrible scarf in church, which I hated wearing. And, you know, there were so many different things. And I could see that, you know, women had to retire from public life, from civil service if they were married. And, you know, there were so few opportunities. And you didn't see women in public positions. It was all men.
There was
all men in the church.
Absolutely. An awful lot to rail against. So I wonder
lot to rail against.
you went to Harvard in 1968, really febrile time in US politics, strong resonances between 1968 and today as well. But I wonder, when you saw so many younger voices asserting themselves over there, how did that shape your politics?
That really was what made a huge difference to me. It was the year of 1967 to 68. You know, it was the year when American contemporaries were criticizing the immoral war in Vietnam and trying to avoid the draft. Martin Luther King was assassinated in April, and just after I graduated, Robert Kennedy was assassinated. And they were terrible events at the time, you know, horrific, appalling events that really shook us all. But what I retained was this sense of young people determined to make a difference. A number of my contemporaries in Harvard weren't going into Wall Street firms. They were going into the civil rights movement or the poverty programs in the south of the country. And I came back to Ireland full of what Nick called, jokingly, my Harvard humility. And that's why, you know, I had the courage to stand the following year and challenge that it was elderly male professors who got the university seats. And my friends said, well, if you're mad enough, why don't you go forward and we'll rally around? And I got elected at the age of 25, which at that time, you know, it took a lot of older people in Trinity, to be honest, professors and things, to trust you know, that a young woman and a Catholic at that would should be given a chance. And I do appreciate, you know, you never win anything like elections on your own. You depend on so many people putting you on their shoulders.
The next sort of thing that brought you to public attention was 1971. You provided legal advice to the contraception train protest. That's all very well documented at this stage. I wonder, what is your feeling about acts of civil disobedience now? Would you be as enthusiastic a supporter of the Just Stop Oil protests, let's say, as you were of the contraception train?
Well, I do believe in the right to protest, and I support it, and I was the lawyer for those who went on the contraceptive train, though I didn't go myself because I didn't want to play that kind of role. You know, more and more, we do need people to stand up for what is right in a time of great misrepresentation and also the climate and nature crisis. You know, governments are not taking it seriously enough, and I admire greatly those young people who go out and protest. And I think you have to be smart about the ways in which you protest. If you disrupt too much people who don't feel this has anything to do with climate, it doesn't help. So you've got to be very smart and strategic. But I do admire those who are smart about the way they protest. But
if you were 50 years younger, do you see yourself providing legal advice to groups like Extinction Rebellion or Just Stop Oil Now?
Yes, absolutely.
You said in the documentary, I hope I'm not misquoting you, you've got to move the climate agenda from the heart. What do you mean by that?
I absolutely believe that. That's what motivates people. It's when they feel, that they want to support something. It's not statistics. It's not fear. It's actually when you get people to realize, you know, we are on the cusp of a much better renewable energy, cleaner, safer, healthier world. We're moving, and indeed we're moving faster, but we're not moving fast enough. That's a human problem. And the way we move faster is by knowing our power and then encouraging governments to take the right decisions, getting out of fossil fuel more rapidly, switching the money from what's harming us. And I use a figure of $1.8 trillion a year is used in harming us in fossil fuel subsidies, etc. If we switched a portion of that, we can incentivize and support that renewable energy is affordable and accessible for everybody. And that's what we need to do in crisis mode now. And that's, you know, very much what I hope the film will encourage, as I hope it will encourage women to, despite the difficulties, and they are very real difficulties these days with social media being very negative and misogynist and racist, etc., that they will go forward into public life and into politics.
You went into politics very, very reluctantly when you were called upon or invited by the Labour Party to run for the presidency. When did you realise during that election, Mary, or was it even after it, that you were the change candidate? That, you know, what was happening here was absolutely about you, but was also about a huge desire for change, and you were the right place, right time person?
Well, when I was nominated by the Labour Party to run as an independent and supported by the other small parties, my whole purpose was to make the case for a much more active president, whoever it would be, and I didn't think it would be me. And that was for the first few months. But as I went round the country and saw the self-development that was going on, which was extraordinary at that time because money had come into rural Ireland from the Common Agricultural Policy, and people wanted the same facilities as the cities, so they knew they wouldn't get them from the government. So they did it by the spirit of Mehel, volunteering, Mehel clubs, Mehel groups. I mean, I saw it all over the country, and it was all about, you know, sports facilities for children, for people with disabilities, that they would have proper facilities for the elderly. And people were proud of joining together to do this. And I recognised the strength of that and talked it up. And people heard that and liked it. And they asked me, well, you know, when you become president, will you come back? And then I kept getting these letters inviting me to come and open a club, you know, recognise 10 years of a project, whatever it was. And that was a great way of going around the country when I became president. And Bride had this map with coloured pins on it, so we'd have a balance between counties and between, you know, issues even.
You did an awful lot on the national stage. You did something very significant on the international stage. So the documentary reminds us of that moment that you lost your composure in Somalia, becoming really upset after the scenes that you had witnessed there. You were annoyed at yourself that you lost your composure, but it was also, was it not, one of the most effective moments of communication of your presidency?
Yes, I felt, you know, I was a lawyer. I should be able to make the case of what I had seen and heard and make it very forcefully. And instead, my voice was breaking and tears were appearing in my eyes. And I'm saying, you know, this shouldn't be happening. And then afterwards, I saw that it had, of course, a much greater impact. And actually, I found in recent years, probably because of the sights I've seen, you know, I have just one layer below in my brain, all kinds of memories of terrible rapes of women, of terrible conflict situations, etc. And I find I am inclined to cry more now. But at that time, I really didn't want it. And yet, as you say, it was much more effective.
You would make an apology in the documentary for having left the presidency a few months early. We'll let people go and watch that for themselves. I wonder, though, do you ever reflect on what you might have done in a second term had you stayed?
No, I must say I became convinced by Nick, by Bride and others that, you know, I'd opened up the presidency. I'd made it clear that it could operate at local level, at national level, at international level, and it was better to hand it over to somebody else. And actually, when the first High Commissioner resigned, I was very focused on, too focused maybe, on getting that job because I allowed Kofi Annan to bully me. What I felt about that part of it, to be honest, Philip, is I was able to tell the story of how difficult it had been to make the decision. But when I realised and the Irish government put me forward for this job, I really wanted to do it and I didn't have any other option. So that's why I allowed myself to be bullied, but it was a mistake. I should have served out my full term. And, you know, that was the mistake. But I was glad to explain and to acknowledge the mistake. And the other mistake, I also was glad that Aoife Kelleher and the, you know, the producers of the film wanted, and Bride wanted to be in the film about Princess Latifah. I just got misled by a friend, allowed myself stupidly to, you know, be very misled and make a very bad interview.
Can I just explain there for people who might not be familiar that this is Princess Latifah who was being held against her will by her father, Sheikh Mohammed, the Prime Minister of the United Arab Emirates.
Nobody knew where she was. And actually, it's not in the film, but what I did the evening that I had met with her and the photographs were taken, which were supposed to be entirely private, I sent them to the High Commissioner for Human Rights as what they call proof of life. That was my purpose, to prove the life. But when the photographs went public, it caused a huge consternation, and rightly so.
And you do, as you say, apologise once again in the documentary for your part in that. But I wonder, knowing what you know now about Sheikh Mohammed, you know, all of the facts that were established in court in London during his divorce, should the bloodstock industry in this country in particular still have such a warm welcome for him?
Well, I think every country has problems. I used to be asked when I was High Commissioner, what's the worst country in the world? And I never answered that question because I said you have to look at the context of countries and every country has its problems. And I prefer to deal with countries as countries and deal with them with their problems. And I think that's what we need to do. That's also part of diplomacy. So you keep the relations, but you speak out about the issues. And I think that's the important thing.
I suspect that the makers of this documentary thought that they were making a programme about somebody who was nearing the end of their career. What becomes very obvious throughout the course of it is that there's another chapter or two left in Mary Robinson yet.
Well, I learned a lesson from my father, which I liked very much. He was a medical doctor who still practiced until the last few weeks when he was 87. He had a few private patients at that stage, of course, and he always said, it is better to wear out than to rust out, and I'm definitely of that view. I think I have a sense, I mean, I have the energy and I have the real sense that we are at a very pivotal moment. We have these precious few years to turn things around and have that wonderful, much better, safer, healthier, renewable energy world, circular economy, much less waste, no waste, and so on. And it's a world that young people know and are working towards. Even school children want to see that world. So, of course, while I have my health, I will work. I'll work for that.
Mrs. Robinson goes on general release towards the end of the month. Mary Robinson, thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
Thank you, Philip.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.